Good morning, everybody.
Ounces of Information by Central States Beverage Company.
Welcome, welcome, one and all, to the June Ounces of Information podcast brought to you by Central States Beverage Company, broadcasting from the CS Bev Marketing Department. I am your host, Aaron Robison, and today is a really big day. One of the biggest names in American craft beer is Founders Brewing Company out of Grand Rapids, Michigan. They've been in our distribution portfolio since 2014 on the Kansas and then Missouri side, and that portfolio speaks for itself. All-day IPA, Centennial IPA, Porter, Dirty Bastard Scotch Ale, Breakfast Stout, and of course, KBS. Each and every one of these beers when they came out were game changers to that style, and to this day continue to hold their own. My guest today is the mastermind behind all of them, Founders Brewmaster Jeremy Kosmicki. He's the one who decided to tweak the recipe for All Day IPA until it was absolutely perfect. And of course, the very man who decided to throw Breakfast Stout, which was a pretty polarizing beer for that time, into a Kentucky bourbon barrel, which was an even more polarizing concept, just to see what would happen. Just the consistent level of innovation and attention to detail are just a few reasons as to why I'm really excited to share this conversation today. So hope you can carve out about an hour of your time and have a little bit of patience with our technical issues here and there. But we're going to get into a lot of stuff. We're going to talk about All Day IPA. We're going to talk about the line extension of All Day Vacay. We're going to talk about the attention to detail of what it took to make Centennial IPA and how Founders decided to actually get into the seltzer game with Moss Agave. And of course, come on guys, we're going to talk KBS. So without further ado, Founders Brewmaster Jeremy Kosmicki.
Can you hear me?
Oh, there we go.
Hey, all right. Jeremy Kosmicki, how are you?
I'm doing great, Aaron. Glad to be here and always excited to talk about beer.
I'm incredibly excited for this conversation because just even as a beer fan alone, let alone being somebody in the industry that's been with Founders in the distribution network since 2014, to be able to talk this lineup that Founders has consistently produced is incredibly exciting for me. So to have the ear of the man behind it all is awesome.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for your support all those years. That's awesome.
You've been at Founders for, I think, what we refer to here in the Heartland as a hot minute. and obviously, like I said a moment ago, you were absolutely instrumental in creating a lot of these beers that made Founders Founders. So if you wouldn't mind, just to kind of kick this off, going a little bit into the early days of your tenure at Founders, like how did you get started and the path that led to right this second?
Awesome. Yeah, sure. I got into homebrewing at a pretty young age. This was back in, the late 90s. I wasn't a big fan of, your normal domestic beers. I mean, I drank them because you had to. But when I started seeing things like, some weird Sam Adams beers and even some Sierra Nevadas and those showing up on the shelves, that was really eye-opening. And it wasn't long after that I bought a homebrew kit. I had a lot of fun with that, impressed my friends, got to get a little crazy. Fast forward a few years after that, and I found myself in a state of unemployment. And sometimes when you're, in those deep, dark moments, when you have nothing to lose, that's when you kind of take some opportunities that you might not normally. So, my wife, my then girlfriend, encouraged me to go down to Founders and apply for a job. But, being that it was right around the year 2000, I had to admit that I was not a Founders fan at the time. Their beers were okay, but I was more into like Bell's beer and some of the more full flavored beers, I suppose. But nonetheless, took a job on their entry level, working on the packaging line, jobs that don't exist these days because of automation, but I was the guy that put the glass on the conveyor belt, and then the other job was at the other end, taking it off and putting it in the boxes and gluing the boxes shut and stacking pallets. But that was my foot in the door. You know, for a guy with a homebrew education, and that was about it. It was an amazing opportunity, and I could tell right from the get-go that Mike and Dave, our owners, were great people, kind people, good-hearted people. So, you know, it was I had nothing to lose, and I gave it everything I got, and I, you know, worked mostly I worked for beer because the wages weren't really anything to speak of. But I survived, and I did everything I could to keep getting more jobs around that place and kind of worked my way up through, you know, I became assistant brewer in 2002, took over head brewer in 2005. And it's just been a wild ride of, you know, we were small back then, a couple thousand barrels a year. You know, I was just living it up, just trying to give these guys some cool new beers, new styles. You know, back then it was they started with pale ales and amber ales and a lager and a wheat beer. I think that was just what every craft brewery made in the late 90s. So, you know, when I brought some homebrew ideas like the Red's Rye, Breakfast Stout, those kind of things, that really turned some heads and just started to create some excitement. And it was small at first, but, you know, with the advent of the internet and a lot of beer rating sites, things kind of quickly started to grow, and we started to gain some, you know, popularity and excitement that you know, we hadn't expected. And you know, it's just been like I said, a wild ride since then.
You know, not to like knock all of the like Siebel Institute brewers or those that like get their chops overseas and come back and get all these professional master's degrees. We're talking just home brewing.
Yeah.
To foot in the door, to production line, to head brewer of Founders Brewing Company.
Yeah. There's something to be said about that experience and hands-on. You know, I see a lot of people come out of brew school, and I think that if you just plopped them into a brewery and said, well, here you go. They would have no idea where to even start. So, you know, my path of taking entry level and just doing every job in the place, working my way up, I don't know that those opportunities exist anymore in the state of the industry. I think there is a lot more, there are a lot more brewers going to school, and I'm not trying to knock school. There's so much you can learn. In fact, I'm the first to admit that I am a very untrained brewer. I'm not sciencey. I have a base understanding of what goes on. My strength to me is with my palate and my recognition of raw materials and how to get the most out of those things. So I'm a pretty simple brewer. I just like to, you know, I have styles of beer that I like. I know my strengths, I know my weaknesses, and the Founders has done an awesome job of surrounding me with competent people. You know, as we've grown, you know, I realize that, man, I'm not super mechanically minded. So, you know, getting a great maintenance staff that knows the equipment, and so it's not me trying to go out there and wrench on these things, that just allows me to do what I do best. So kudos to Founders for supporting me and making it work.
I mean, yeah, absolutely dead on. And honestly, man, if nothing else, you just validated every Drake song ever. Like, started from the right here. You know?
Exactly.
So you talk about like going from those just original, every single brewer at that time was doing these kind of styles to a lot of these styles that you were pitching of some of the crazier stuff. What was the first beer that Mike and Dave were like, all right, buddy, go do that and see what we can come up with?
Yeah, I think I'm pretty sure it was Breakfast Stout. That so we used to not make any beers that didn't go into production. So, you know, the stuff that was in kegs and six packs, that's what we made. Now, we had a pretty nice tasting room, a tap room there. But what we were missing was that angle of, man, making stuff just for the tap room and doing some experimenting with some new recipes. Like these guys right from the get-go were poised to be a production brewery. You know, we had a 30 barrel brew house actually, which doesn't seem like much, but back then that meant, you know, you're going for it. You're packaging your beer, you're sending it out there. You're not just a brew pub. But we were missing that angle of the cool thing about a brew pub where you get new beers out all the time. So, you know, one of the first things that me and the head brewer at the time, Nate Walser, who was actually a homebrew buddy of mine, so that worked out great. We were responsible for just making some new beers, and we built this little tiny, you would call it a nano brewery today, And, you know, and we made things like I said, breakfast stout, Red's Rye. I think those were the first two that we did on there. And my intention was never to bottle up these beers and put them in the lineup. I just wanted to make cool stuff for the tap room to draw some people in there and to make it a cool spot. We had a great, you know, music scene going. I just wanted to, you know, give people a reason to come down there. But Mike and Dave, you know, they tasted these beers and they saw some potential there and like, we want to put these things in a bottle. So, you know, Dirty Bastard came shortly after that. But that was really an explosion of making beers that were outside the scope of what everybody else was doing. And that certainly, you know, drew some attention.
For sure. We were actually talking in the office earlier about Dirty Bastard and just a fantastic take on the Scotch ale that it is. And what kind of makes it so mind-blowing these days is that it's really, really hard to, you know, I obviously don't have to tell you, but like once you brew a style and you're known for like being the absolute standard for that style, it's kind of hard to maintain that position with all the breweries coming up with all these innovations in this country alone. But Founders and Dirty Bastard Scotch Ale is still the epitome of Scotch Ales in a lot of people's minds, myself included.
I love it because, you know, I mean, Scotch Ales weren't like a, it wasn't like a big style back when we invented it. And it's certainly not a big style these days either. But man, we owned that thing by just kind of embracing it. And the funny thing about that beer is that, you know, I think Mike and Dave wanted to name a beer Dirty Bastard. They wanted it big and high alcohol. And so, you know, we kind of just thought that a Scotch ale would fit. And we made just big malty thing at a time when nobody was drinking, you know, 8.5% malt forward beers. But that beer in particular, you know, that it's weird that it kind of served as like a gateway beer for a lot of people, because a lot of people like myself didn't really love the taste of your traditional domestic lagers and maybe IPAs or hoppy beers are off-putting. So that sweetness behind Dirty Bastard really seemed to like, it's just so different. It's so different from any beer that you had before. It really was like a, and of course the alcohol and the value of it, you know, it was the same price as our pale ale at 5.5%. You could get a Dirty Bastard for 8.5%. So that was, I'm sure that figured into a lot of people's choices when they were, you know, people tell me all the time that Dirty Bastard was their first craft beer, or first Founders beer at least. And yeah, that always makes me chuckle.
it's a good point bringing up the introductory portion centered kind of around ABVs, because I think, mm-hmm. you know, you've obviously worked your fair share of beer festivals and
right.
We'll come up to your
tent. Your strongest thing.
Yeah, it's like, whatever's going to get me messed up quickest, you know? Like, I get that. But, you know, and it's just a testament to the entire portfolio. Whenever we launched with Founders, it was crazy to think about, even just from our marketing perspective, having a brewery coming to town with a beer, not a single beer, you know, talk about beer ratings, that rated under 95% on Rate Beer.
The internet ratings have been kind to us, and you know, the roundness, the fullness of our portfolio, and the fact that, you know, I can get behind every one of our beers, and you know, it might not be your style, but when you can drink and recognize that, you know, that's pretty good for what it is, I'm not going to go to it, but I can't find anything wrong with it, you know, that's the ultimate compliment to me. But that's, I like that a lot.
You know, I guess a really good starting off point to kind of start pulling some of these out and individualizing them is All Day IPA. One of those beers being such a staple in the Founders portfolio. I hear that there's a story behind this Session IPA. Do you have one for me?
Oh, sure. We can talk about this. I mean, All Day is probably my, you know, my crowning achievement to this day. And the beautiful thing about it is, like I said, we really cut our teeth and made our mark with these, you know, high ABV, you know, full flavor, even barely we had started to get into. And that was like, that was really driving our popularity. But, you know, coming out with all day was the right beer at the right time. And we all knew internally, as we're hop heads. And so, you know, Centennial IPA was our IPA, and that's generally what we all gravitated for. But and working in the beer industry, sometimes you gravitate, you know, a little sooner in the day than a normal person. And you know, a Centennial IPA is over 7% alcohol, so you start on a couple of those earlier in the afternoon, and it makes for a very unproductive rest of your day. So what we all wanted, at least internally, was a beer that satisfied that hop craving at a sessionable level that allowed us to continue to be productive and go home to our families and, you know, and not be wasted. So, that really drove that. You know, fortunately, back in, you know, mid 2000s when we started working on this, it wasn't a thing. There wasn't a race. It wasn't like, this is the latest fad. You got to come up with your beer as quick as possible or we're going to miss this window, which is kind of how I feel goes on a lot these days. So I had time to really dial in that recipe. And thank God I did, because it turns out that style of beer, it took a lot of work. Getting the balance down when you're trying to make a hop forward thing at a lower alcohol and a lower body, but not too thin of a body. You want to have something in there to balance that bitterness, but not too much because it's still got to be sessionable. So we went back and forth. I think the official count on, at least on the tour walk, you'll see is that it was like 20 stabs at this beer. And it's probably about right in different iterations and trying out different hops and changing up the malt bill. But when I finally nailed it, man, I knew I had it. And of course, I didn't know that it was going to get to the level that it got to. But like I said, it was the right beer at the right time when I think a lot of people were feeling like we did and wanted to enjoy a tasty craft beer at a value. You know, when we came out with those 15 packs, you know, that kind of changed the industry. So the stars aligned for that one for sure.
I think you're actually hitting it right on the head, too, whenever you were talking about coming out at the right time, you know, right place mm-hmm. and everything. It speaks to this market that not only just doesn't want to like come home wasted after, you know, working all day, more people that are in it for the flavor, but not necessarily in it to, you know, just like you said, get wasted constantly. And all day definitely speaks to that sessionable ability to keep the party going.
Sure. Yeah. My vision for this brand is that it's, you're going to go to the beer store and you're going to pick out the newest, hottest six pack or whatever you're interested in. But all day is that 15 pack that's going to just remain, hold a spot in your fridge because, you know, it's kind of like, it's like the Bud Light for those of us that care about, you know, flavor. That's just, that's your go-to drinker and you'll try other things. But I really think that all day has earned a spot, at least in my fridge.
Yeah, no, mine as well. Good point. It is definitely the, I'm going to grab something new, but I also know what I'm going to go for too. It also has a line extension this year and we just recently, brought all day vacay to Kansas City. So obviously, you know, we think wheat beers are incredibly popular, especially around here. So what was the idea behind bringing a session wheat ale, to accompany all day IPA?
Yeah. Pretty interesting, progression here. So, you know, when the idea came up, I was a little bit leery because, you know, all day is the bread and butter at this point, and it's, you don't want to screw that up. So I was very careful about not just putting something out there to capitalize on a brand, but you see it working. You see it in a lot of other breweries with their line extensions, taking a popular thing and doing, you know, variations of it. I've always kind of shied away from that because I don't like gimmicks. I don't like gimmicks, especially within our industry. It's a big turnoff for me. But as the more I thought about it, the all day brand has that equity, and you know, it feels like summer. It feels like you know, fruits and beaches and vacations. So. You know, it took quite a few stabs to get this recipe dialed in. Not quite as much as the original all day, but you know, it was when you're talking about these delicate light beers with a flavor profile that is towing the line. You can't have any of those flavor attributes out of whack, or it's going to screw up the whole thing. So there was a lot of small tweaking here and there, but once again, I'm pretty happy with where it ended up. I think it's a great summer beer. It's actually the highest velocity beer in my fridge right now, right next to my all day 15 pack. I saved spot for a vacay, and I've been digging on it. And I think especially as soon as the weather starts even warming up more, it's going to become a real go-to for me.
It is a absolute delicious drinking session wheat ale. It's very, very good. Just out of curiosity, because I know you mentioned a couple times that like this takes a lot of tweaking in the process. Whenever you talk about like tweaking things and recipes like 19, 20, 25 times, does this mean you are legit brewing this style of the beer every single time before you reach that ultimate conclusion?
Yes. So So, you know, and this was hard too, because I rely on, we got a great tap room here. We have our original tap room was great, but we moved to this new location in 2007 with the idea of, you know, man, people want to come here and drink beer. And so I don't have my smallest brew house here in Grand Rapids is still the original 30 barrel system, which I can brew 20 barrels on. And honestly, 20 barrels of a taproom beer has been a pretty good size. If it's a really hot beer, it's gone in a couple of weeks. If it's, you know, a bit of a snoozer, maybe it takes a couple months to deplete. But it's an awesome opportunity to get some new ideas out there and get feedback. And, you know, you know right away if it sells quick, if people are talking about it, I think you got a hit on your hands. You know, fast forward to pandemic times, and, you know, we're at capacity restrictions. So we're not going through as much beer in the tap room as normal. So it makes it extra hard when I have to brew this stupid beer, like, you know, several times over a period of months. A lot of beer got dumped in the process of figuring this out, because I just can't deplete it all in the tap room. So that always makes me pretty sad. But, you know, we got there. It's the price of doing business, and it's absolutely worth it to, you know, get something dialed in and get it right and spend a little time. I feel like I don't want to bemoan the industry right now, but I think there's a lot of, when you're a small brewery and you just make something new and it is what it is, and you put it in a can and you send it out there. Maybe I'm a little more old school, but gosh, I don't want to release anything until I'm completely happy with where it's at and have it dialed in. So, you know, I appreciate my boss has given me that opportunity, and they generally think I'm pretty quick about it, but man, sometimes it's just not quite right, you know, and I don't want to get it out there until it's right where I want it.
No, and I think, you know, obviously not to pull a massive sales tactic out of thin air here, but like it, just knowing the brewing process, and for anybody listening at home, obviously it takes a lot just to get that beer into the can or into that keg. It takes weeks to brew these things. And if you're talking 20, 25 iterations, this all-day vacuum and all-day IPA is a year's project.
Years. Yep.
That is so anybody listening, we're not just, you know, you're not just pulling things out and saying, just put it in a can, it's good.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, in the industry these days, that's you know, it's almost kind of required. I mean, fads come and go so quick that I ain't got time to do, you know, to spend a year working on a beer. By the time you get it dialed in, guess what? The consumer's ready for something else. So, you know, we're a big company, and not only does it take me a long time to dial in the beer, but, you know, the marketing of it, designing the label and come up with a name and going through all the necessary legal ramifications of making your beer, that all that stuff takes time. So the bigger you get, the slower all that gets. And I feel like we kind of move it up. We're not in a position to react really quickly and hop on fads. So I, you know, and nobody really wants to do that. We're much more comfortable kind of putting our stake in the ground and being like, this is the next thing. This is what we're going to do. Now, of course, there's situations all the time where it's like, no, we need a seltzer. So that was a decision that was made and something that I had to figure out real quick. Like, I still believe in our direction and the fact that we're not just hopping trends for and throwing stuff at a wall to see what sticks. I think that we're making sound decisions based on product that we want to get behind and hoping that aligns with where the consumer's at in any given moment.
You know, I you touched on a couple of things I know we're going to obviously talk about here real quick, but just to like kind of differentiate, I guess, between the terminology of like fad and trend, like, you know, I guess in my mind, I view things like a fad in the beer industry, like a brewed IPA, where it was a very short-lived stint. And there's a couple really good examples of execution on that one. But then there's things like trends with like hazy IPAs. Real quick on IPAs, because I know I got a couple that I still kind of want to talk about, but where do you see the quote unquote haze craze going now that it's reached the point that it's reached?
Yeah. So that's another one that I've struggled with because it's not my style. I don't love it. And I didn't think it was going to do what it did and the longevity of it. And so my initial reaction was, don't go there. This is, first of all, I don't really like the style. So it's really hard for me to like design a style of beer that that I'm not passionate about. You know what I mean? It's I don't exactly know what is good or what I'm looking for. I felt like every hazy I was trying just didn't do it for me. So I avoided that thing for as long as I possibly could. Much to the chagrin of my, sales team that is out there trying to sell against all these examples, like we just need one. So, I think finally I caved, and I have been working on these lately. And then, of course, maybe I'm late to the party again. But what it really took was finding some pretty good commercial examples that I could get some inspiration from, and kind of really, find our way. Because let's be honest, that hazy style of beer originated with like small brew pubs and smaller places that would make these things, and you package it and you sell it that day, and it sells out, and people go home and drink it, and they're like, wow, awesome. A brewery like us, where I gotta make a product like this that I feel good about sending all over the country and even into other countries, there's a pretty big difference between what a brewery like, some of the originals, Trillium, Treehouse, versus what some of the bigger, national distributed companies are doing. There's a pretty big difference, I think, in those hazies. To me, they're like different kinds of beers. And you just have to, if you're Sierra or New Belgium and you're making a hazy IPA, you have to take into account that this thing has to have some shelf stability. So once I kind of got a flavor in mind and started working on how do you make something that is acceptable to the style but still will be stable on the shelves as we're sending it around everywhere, it got a little easier for me, and I got a little inspiration. So I have to say I've been working on some hazies lately, and of course I know I'm late to the game, and all my sales people are pointing fingers at me being like, I told you so, but here we are. And sometimes it just takes that long. I gotta get inspired. I gotta feel it before I can get, the necessary passion to make it happen for us.
In a lot of ways, though, I wouldn't necessarily, it's kind of an injustice to say that you're quote unquote late to the game, because it does feel like, in terms of like hazy and unfiltered IPAs, New England style IPAs, like we've kind of transcended that point where it's just a phase or a fad or hype or anything. Mm-hmm. It's a legit style and it's here to stay. And I think it's a big part of that's obviously because it introduced a whole lot of people to the IPA style that probably would have otherwise not ever been a part of it. But, you mentioned the quality issues and everything that goes into it as well. I think, obviously in this industry, it kind of has to do, there's a little bit of fortune telling involved, a little bit of trying to predict the future. And whenever it comes to like that style, when it first came out, you're absolutely right. It was crazy. Like, it was really good. It was delicious. It was something you never had before. But, speaking from my own personal tastes, I've kind of like had it now. And so now I'm like gravitating back towards those bitter, piney West Coast IPAs if I'm going to drink hoppy at all. So,
sure.
Where I guess would it be wise to kind of point the fortune tellers and say, do you think the direction of IPA is heading, let's say, 1, 2, 5 years from now?
Yeah, tough to say. I mean, obviously everything is there's some cyclicity to everything. I think that we've seen a Centennial IPA is on fire for us. It's one of our like fastest growing brands, and that's an original brand. That's an old school IPA, right? Centennial hops. It's got some caramel malt in there for balance. It's a really great beer, and it was the benchmark of what IPAs were, back in the mid to late 2000s. And the fact that beer is doing so well for us kind of makes me think that people will go out and they'll drink their hazies and they'll get hooked and they're just looking for something else. And I think Centennial kind of toes that line between, it's got some of that sweetness. It's not West Coast. It's not completely pale and dry and bitter, which are great. I love those styles of beers too. But, our Centennial is like a Midwest IPA where you're trying to really toe the line between that dry bitter and that sweet malty thing. So I love the fact that beer is doing well for us. And we used to have a pale ale, a dry hopped American pale ale that we don't make anymore because nobody drinks pale ales anymore. But I just made a batch for the tap room specifically just a couple weeks ago. And man, I was drinking that and thinking to myself, you know what I said? I said, this style will come around again. American pale ale we'll make a comeback. That's just kind of how it goes. All the retro things. And I said, well, awesome, because I got a great recipe. And, man, I'm ready to go. As soon as American Pale Ale comes back into favor, I got this.
I can tell you, like, just as a beer fan, how exciting that is to hear, because I remember quite specifically the dry hop pale ale, and I'm ready for that comeback, man. I hear there was a little bit of a process creatively behind Centennial IPA, and obviously this was another one of your brain children. What went into making that one?
Yeah, so when I started at Founders, took that assistant brewer job, and my buddy Nate that I was talking about, he took the head brewer job like right around that same time. So here we were, you know, a couple of homebrew buddies thrust into this thing, and you know, the number one objective at that point was to fix the IPA, make the IPA something that we were proud of, because that's what all my friends were drinking, that's what we all loved. And, you know, our IPA was fine. It was, you know, it was pretty textbook. It was not that far off from the current recipe. It was just lacking. So we did some things like jack up that dry hop, you know, really try to make the hops, in particular the hops, and when we added them in the process too. You know, there's a thing about biotransformation these days, which is a big part of getting those hops in there. But the idea is to get those hops into the dry hop while the beer is still fermenting. And so that was kind of a new thing that we were into, and we really noticed the differences. But dialing in that their IPA recipe was priority number one. I don't know, maybe you've heard this story. I think I've told it before, but a friend of ours, he would get a keg every year for his birthday party. Keg of beer, and we would drink this beer. So we started working at Founders, and man, I could get you a keg at a really good price, probably even free. And my buddy's like, well, actually, I think I'm just gonna buy it from other brewery here in town. I was like, damn it, really? You won't even take this beer for free? So that's when we knew we seriously have to get this beer under control. We got to make it so that at least my friends will buy it, because, you know, that's a microcosm of the industry. But if my friends aren't drinking it, then it can't be good.
So it's safe to say that, you know, he's going to get as many free cakes of Centennial as he can now.
Oh no, he's got to pay now.
Yeah, it is. Thanks for helping me create this. Now pay up. And you're absolutely right. It is just an absolute fantastic drink. Just I don't know any other way to put it now, since we've transversed the style as often as we can from West Coast to East Coast. It's a good Midwest IPA.
I think that's what it is. You know, it's in the, you know, I already told you how much I love Bell's, but that two-hearted ale was really what made me want to create beer. I wanted to create beer like that aroma, that mouthfeel. So, you know, it's no secret that Centennial is molded in the spirit of Two-Hearted.
Nice. Little tip of the cap. Very cool. There is one more IPA that I did want to spotlight and talk about, and it is Unraveled IPA. I don't. Yeah. I feel like the term isn't hazy. Is juicy?
Yeah, so here's the story behind this one, right? So I'm under all this pressure, right? And you know, hazy IPAs are taking over the world. Hazy Little Thing came out, and holy cow, did it do insane things. So I've been working on I'm a man of balance. I liked my beers to, you can be extreme, but you got to balance out those flavors. So I was working on this beer. It was a hop forward beer, and it was really kind of pushing the boundaries, pushing my limits of how much I really enjoyed hop character before I was like, yeah, it's a bit much. Anyway, so this beer is kind of where I ended up with, like, this is my extreme thing. And it wasn't hazy. It was, you know, it was like all our other beers. It was clean. It was crisp, but that hop character was way up there. So, and a lot of people got on board, and they're like, hey, this beer's got potential. Let's get this into a package and send it out. And you know, the feedback comes in from the salespeople. They all like the beer, and they're like, man, it's not hazy though. And I'm like, well, no, it's not hazy, but doesn't it taste awesome? And they're like, yeah, but man, can we at least put juicy on the label? I'm like, I don't know. Does it taste like juice? And so we went to the store, and we bought every competitor's beer that put juicy on the label, right? And there's lots of them. And I brought them back and we did a side by side. And based on what everybody else was calling juicy, I said, okay, I think we're cool with calling this beer juicy. If that's going to help you, that's going to help you sell this beer, I'm all for it. So we kind of landed on juicy. I don't know why it has to be like murky, murky haze. I think that, you know, from a scientific standpoint, what you really want is some, you want some proteins, stable protein in suspension to give your hop polyphenol something to cling to and really accentuate that hop aroma and flavor. So I don't think you're doing yourself any favors by having more haze, but you know, I do see the scientific evidence behind having some proteins in there and the resulting sheen that comes with it. So man, I love that beer. I think that thing is dialed in, and the more I drink it, now I am convinced that juicy is a good word for it. It's kind of, you know, but juicy in like a grapefruit citrus way, probably more so than the tropical fruit that's maybe generally more associated with the hazy IPA. But gosh, I love where that beer ended up. Like I said, it was pushing my hop limits for a while, but now I'm pretty used to it, and it's become a real staple. So next to the, I have room for 4 15 packs, right? So I got all day, I got JK, keep unraveled, and then there's a rotating one that switches between like Centennial or Seltzer depending on what time of year it is.
Nice, very cool. I totally agree. I think it complements both All Day and Centennial nice in the IPA portfolio. It's good to see it year round. I'm pretty excited about that. Let's keep the trend train going here. I mentioned it just a moment ago, but I feel like we would be amiss if we didn't at least talk seltzer.
Right.
You know, as much as I love talking IPA, we got to move on to the fizzier boy in the room. We brought in Moss Agave Hard Seltzers, I think, to launch Q2 with here this year. The three flavors, lime, grapefruit, strawberry. We got the 15 pack and the variety, and we got the variety pack as well. It's obviously interesting to see how seltzer has just literally come in and not only taken center stage, but almost all but entirely bought the stage. It's a totally world within itself. How did the conversation come about to say we're Founders Brewing Company and we're going to make seltzer?
Well, I mean, I pushed back on seltzer even harder than I pushed back on hazy IPA. So it just wasn't something that I certainly didn't have any passion for. And once again, you know, I told you that if I can't buy into it, I just can't create it. So, but man, I think the bosses and, you know, everybody kind of looked at ourselves and looked at what's going on in the industry and said, holy cow, if you don't make an effort to get on some seltzer here, you're probably going to be really sorry in a few years. And you know, I understood that. I'm an artist first, but I got some business sense in me, and I knew that was the right thing to do. So, yep, forced myself to go out and drink a bunch of seltzer, which I generally was unimpressed with for the reasons that for the obvious reasons. I think that most seltzers really lack an authentic natural character, right? You put some no calorie flavoring in there, and you get a pop aroma, and then you go to drink it, and it's because of the low calorie stigma that comes with it. There's just not much there. And that's, you know, that's kind of the thing for the style, right? People want to, they're used to drinking LaCroix. Can I just get that with a little bit of alcohol in it? Sure. Yeah. 100 calories and 5% is kind of where the math works out. But the most disappointing thing to me was always the aftertaste and how it left, my palate feeling. So, and I know that to hit those 100 calories and 5% alcohol, you got to use some fake sweetener, Or you end up being really dry and kind of flavorless. So I'm pretty sensitive to the fake sweetener. I don't drink diet pop, so it really stands out to me as kind of offensive. So I wanted to avoid that. And so we went down the path of using real juice. And, you know, like I said, you have that math equation of you can get 100 calories and 5% alcohol with that sugar level. So I kind of found that I asked him what my limits were. And we decided to, we would be appropriate to swing a little bit less alcohol and a little more calories and use actual fruit juice And it made all the difference to me. It really it got you a more authentic fruit flavor and balanced sweetness without being fake. And then and that after the a pleasant aftertaste that kind of leaves you with just that you know, a real fruit character. Adding the salt to it is a little trick I learned through the barrel aged masagave thing. I wanted that to be a part of it because, gosh, it really helps with mouthfeel. And it's, when you're talking about a thin, relatively simple beverage, the addition of just a little bit of salt will go a long ways to kind of filling up your mouth and making it seem fuller than it you know, the gravity actually reads. And you know, and then picking the right sugar source. So you know, there's a lot of ways to go about it. You can get some pretty cheap sugars out there, but what you end up tasting is a pretty cheap tasting alcohol. You know, it tastes like cheap liquor. So we went all out with cane sugar and agave, and I think we made you know, in my mind, of course I'm a little biased, but I think, you know, it's one of the best seltzers out there. And I'm not a seltzer guy, so maybe my opinion doesn't mean anything, but I finally got something that I was proud of, and that was what really allowed this project to go forward. And yeah, now I think we had a lot to learn, because making seltzer is not making beer. Yeah, we share some equipment. We had to get some new equipment, but man, we had a lot to learn as we went about the whole process. So everybody kind of embraced it around here. Eventually, once I got them sold that we can make something that tastes good, then it was a matter of just dialing in the production process. And you know, we got really smart people working here, and everybody was played an instrumental role in getting it to where it is today.
That's awesome. And I think you hit it literally right on the head, because we've had this conversation in some podcasts prior about, you know, the seltzer category, and yeah, it's blown up, and yeah, it's to the point where you can't ignore it anymore, obviously, but yeah. Like it's on its nose, man, it's fizzy water with flavoring. Like how innovative can you get? And everything you just said is exactly what made Founders Approach to Seltzer a very Founders Approach to Seltzer, where, you know, the big thing for me, like you just said, is the aftertaste, and you can tell whatever it's that sweetener versus actual real sugar. And using, is it agave nectar is what you're throwing in there?
Yeah.
Using that agave nectar is actually a big difference maker, and you can tell with every sip.
Yeah, like I said, I'm happy where it landed. I still wouldn't call myself a seltzer guy, but they do have the time and place. You know, I find, so you know, I drink a lot of all day, but you know, if it's a Saturday and man, I'm mowing the lawn, I'm gonna hit the pool, and I'm just crushing beers. Eventually, your palate can get overwhelmed by even a beer like All Day, which I think is pretty well balanced. But I like to work in those seltzers. That's just kind of a palate cleanser, something to reset yourself. It's not overwhelming. It, you know, the light fruit, the it's a bit thirst quenching. So I think they have their time and place. And like I said, sometimes they're in my fridge in a 15 pack, which I never would have guessed two years ago.
You know, honestly, it kind of diversifies the fridge for the neighborhood too, because every now and then you see that friend or that family member that comes in, they're like, "Hey, you got anything that isn't bread soda?" You know, this is the answer. Yeah. Even the gluten-free community, it's game changer.
Yeah, finally we have a something that's gluten-free, and that's you know, that's always been a request of mine, and I'm glad to finally have something that, you know, fills a niche. I'm all about a round portfolio that fills niches, as long as I can get behind the product that we come up with. So I don't ever want to put something out there just for the sake of, gosh, we need this style. You know what I mean? It's got to fit Founders. I think we've established a reputation for quality, value, and you know, it's got to fit. That's on me. Nobody else in this business is going to make sure that that those requisites are met. So yeah, I'm proud to put out a seltzer.
genuinely appreciate that attention to detail and obviously getting behind the product. I was asked to press just a little bit by Miss Ashley Kroll, our Kansas City founder.
Love Ashley.
You know, as of right now, we got three masagave flavors. We got lime, grapefruit, and strawberry. Is there going to be more here in the very near future?
Oh man, so kind of the name of the game in this seltzer thing is like the rotation and variety. So I am definitely working on the R&D side for some other flavors. You know, I'll have to admit that when these first came out, and I was like, yep, okay, three flavors. and I worked really hard, and I really worked hard to dial those things in. And and before we had even released them on a national level, marketing was like, okay, well, we need 3 more new flavors. And I was like, are you kidding me? You got to be kidding me. But I get it. That's the name of the game. So we don't have any plans right now to release anything else. But the R&D is definitely going in there, and we're trying to find some other flavors that work.
Is there a favorite that's emerging? I'm just pressing a little bit further. That's all I'm going to do.
I think that there's been a bit of a trend that I see with like lemonade based. Seltzer. So I've kind of been angling on there. Lemonade provides a nice base sweetness, but also that tartness that citrus offers. And to me, those are important parts of making the seltzer. Like, you can't lean too hard into just a flat fruit, a stone fruit or something. Like, you know, even the berries can come across just a little bit plain. So if you read the label on even our strawberry seltzer, you'll see there's some lime in there too. I think that citrus cutting through is a big part of the appeal of a seltzer. So I think lemonade is a great base to work with some other flavors. So I got some of those in the works. I'm really doing is taking our seltzer base, and I got these. I do have little like 3-barrel tanks, and we're mixing it up. And I got my fruit people on all their. I'm basically trying everything.
Say no more. I'm already excited. So that's a solid start for the innovation. So I me being the beer fan that I am, and you of course being you, Jeremy Kosmicki, I would probably be doing everyone listening the biggest of disservices if I didn't bring up KBS.
Yeah.
Your name is on the bottle, sir. Like, you're the creator of this legendary liquid. And just, I guess, before we kind of get into like KBS and what it is in 2021, what was the process behind bringing Kentucky Breakfast Stout into the world?
Yeah, so this dates back to mine and Nate's days. We had made Breakfast Stout, and we came across a couple of bourbon barrels. There weren't hardly any commercial examples of bourbon barrel aged beer. You know, Goose was doing it. That's probably what kind of got it in our heads. But you know, what can you do with a bourbon barrel? So we put some breakfast out into those 2 barrels, let it sit for a year, and a year later we were like, holy cow, there's some really cool flavors coming through there. Needed to make some tweaks to the base recipe because over that year of aging, it had kind of lost some of that. Some of the coffee and chocolate pop that we loved from the original breakfast stout. And also, it kind of thinned out. It seemed like it lost a bit of that mouthfeel. So we made some adjustments to the base beer, of course, making a higher gravity so you get more mouthfeel, a little more alcohol, and bumped up the chocolate coffee. And the next year we bought 4 bourbon barrels and filled them up with this new recipe. And that seemed to be it. And the next year we bought, I think, 8 bourbon barrels, which was enough to fill, a 20 barrel tank all into bourbon barrels. And I think we actually packaged that up. And that would have been the first year we packaged KBS, just sold it out of our store. store. We didn't have a store. We had a cooler, a to-go cooler in the tap room where these KBS bottles just kind of sat there for forever because barrel aged beer wasn't popular and it was expensive. And I think people were confused, intimidated. Either way, nobody bought the shit. Regardless, we thought it was cool. So we did it again the next year. And I think we even made, more the next year. We doubled it again. I think we went to 16 that next year, to 2 tankfuls. And about that time is when it started to get some action on the beer advocate, rate beer, those types of things, where kind of a word of mouth thing started to spread about, holy cow, have you had this bourbon barrel aged, chocolate coffee oatmeal imperial stout from Founders? And so, and eventually, I think either that year or the next year when we released it, all of a sudden there's a line out the door on the morning that we had it packaged, and and it just kind of grew from there. And it was pretty amazing to watch every year as we make a little bit more and the lines get longer. And that was something that was completely new to probably the industry and us in particular. But what a cool thing to experience and then figure out how to manage it, right? Because you want to make enough to satisfy some of these people, but you know you're a bit limited. We weren't a barrel aging brewery at the time. We didn't have anywhere to put these barrels, so which kind of led to us finding some space. I don't know if you heard about the old gypsum mines, the caves in Grand Rapids where we store these things. But that provided a really cool story and an experience for people that got to go down and check it out. And it just kind of grew from there and, you know, super cool. And fast forward to where we are now and, you know, everybody barrel ages beers. And there's some really ridiculous barrel aged beers that are highly sought after and get amazing scores on the rating sites. And to me, you know, I love the fact that KBS is still a thing. And we made a decision to, why not, you know, we are set up to make a lot of this beer. I can make a lot of it. We barrel age, we've got the process in place. We've got the recipes dialed in. We've got the connection to the barrels, all the bourbon barrels that we, you know, we stand behind because we've been doing it so long. We know which barrels we like and we have access to them. So why not try to get it to people? I still run into people every year. They're like, oh man, I really want to try KBS. I can't find it. I'm like, really? Because it's like everywhere now. But, you know, and with that came some pushback from from the beer. I'll call them connoisseurs, but I really mean the beer nerds that, you know, they chase after these highly sought after beers. And gosh, when they can get them too easily, then they just aren't cool anymore. And so you know, I have a hard time understanding that because I was at a point in my life where I was pretty sick of waiting in lines. Chasing trucks, everything that goes along with it, but that is part of the game for people. So, you know, us growing the KBS volume, has I feel like it's been met with some mixed results. Obviously, it's nice to be able to go and get it any time of year. Now it's year round too, but for some of the diehards, it seemed to have lost a little luster, knowing that you can just get KBS anytime you want. So is what it is. I think we did what we had to do with that brand and I still love the quality of it. I think it's one of the most, you know, I'll throw balanced in there again, because it really is, you're taking all these different flavors. And I think we really have it dialed in where each flavor has its own little spot where there's, you know, and hits you with the coffee first and then the finish kind of chocolatey. And of course the wood itself and the base beer, it's a really great, stout recipe. So, I'm happy that it still is what it is. And, it's certainly something, I'm super proud of.
You know, I know we didn't do the video component to this conversation, but you know, I do just wanted to reiterate that there is a massive smile on my face with this part of the conversation, because one, like, you know, the business side of it, I'm absolutely alluding to it with the whole like losing out on the beer geek factor of it, no longer having to chase the trucks for it, but just the concept behind KBS, this beer, it's one of those beers in a very short list of beers that people that have had it most often remember the first time and first place that they've had it. You know, it's a bonding moment between my brother-in-law and myself whenever he had never had it for the first time. And his brother had told him about it. And he's like, I don't know where I can find it. And I'm like, right here in my fridge, you know, just popped it open. But, I you talk about the having the ability to make it a year round product, which is crazy enough in my mind as it is. I kind of want to go into that just a little bit more. Like a beer that is so labor intensive and complex as Kentucky Breakfast Stout, what exactly goes into making that a consistent tasting year-round beer?
Yeah, real quick, I'll allude to, you know, before KBS it was Breakfast Stout, right? And we made Breakfast Stout, you know, like I said, originally just for the tap room. It was going to be like just a one-off thing, and we had so much fun. You know, here we are, we're weighing out coffee and steeping it and melting chocolate, and the whole brewery smells amazing, and everyone's giving high fives and loving it. You know, as like a once a year thing, it was really awesome because it's super labor intensive. So fast forward to a couple years later, and when Mike and Dave were like, "Yep, we want to put this beer in bottles and mass produce it," and I was like, "Are you kidding me? This beer is the biggest pain in the ass to make that I've ever done." And You find some ways to streamline some stuff, but there ain't no getting around the fact that you got to melt chocolate, you got to steep coffee, and it's all these extra steps. And especially when you get to a production brewery like we are, man, those beers are a real pain in the ass. But it's still a labor of love, and everybody loves the end result, so they're willing to put in the extra work. Throw in KBS, and now, oh my God, now you got to manage, filling and emptying barrels, storing the barrels, moving the barrels. But we had to embrace it, you know. I think that we wanted to kind of own the barrel aged category, and I think we are good at it, and set ourselves up for it. We built a whole facility called the Barrel House to manage these kind of things. So any sort of like, I don't know, it felt disingenuous to pretend like there's some sort of volume restrictions on KBS, you know, not make enough just to keep it rare. It didn't feel right. You know, I think people knew that we were poised to make a lot of this stuff. So I was fine with doing it, and we put the production steps in place to kind of streamline a lot of the handling of the barrels, which is at this point the biggest hassle with that. But still, it's when we're emptying those barrels, every barrel has got to get tested and make sure that it's doing what it's supposed to do. Make sure it's ready. Now we've grown from experience over time that we know how long generally these things take. But when you move to a year round schedule, that gets a little bit thrown out. You know, when we used to release it only in March, we knew that all that liquid had to be in wood the previous March, because I know that it takes 12 months before I'm happy with where this beer is at. You know, when you change it to going year round, now you've got you're just making it year round and hoping that you're making the right volume a year ago that you're going to be selling in the following year. So a lot of blending has goes into it now, and we've got a pretty good handle on that. So you can take some 10-month beer and some 14-month beer and blend it, and you'll have an idea of where you really want to be. So it's been great. I still love it. I still have a big role in the barrel aging and emptying barrels and tasting barrels and creating new styles too. You know, it's just, you don't stop at KBS. We have a couple of spots in our barrel series every year for some new stuff. And that keeps it fun. You know, it's the longer you go at this, I'm always afraid of like jumping the shark and just doing something stupid just because I'm out of ideas and you gotta do something for purely hype. I try to avoid that as much as I can. And even like these KBS variants that we came out with, I push back on variants quite a bit because, like I said, I hate gimmicks. But when there was no turning back, and we saw that, there was a huge demand for, KBS has a great brand recognition. And you can take a beer and do something with it, like a variant, and create that excitement. We saw that it not only creates that extra volume, but it helps boost the KBS brand in general. So, but when I got behind that idea, I wanted to keep it to, the first year we did just an enhanced coffee. I got espresso in there. So we made an espresso version of it for the coffee lovers that really love that aspect of the beer. And then the next year I did the Mackinac fudge, which really boosted the chocolate aspect of that beer. So I'm trying not to get too wacky with this, at least right away, because this is a bit of a long game, and you don't want to throw it all out there on your first one and then be like, wow, geez, what do I do now to top that? Because I see that happening in a lot of these hype breweries. This, you start down that path of every beer's got to up the last beer, and where do you end up? How do you keep out hyping yourself? So, I'm trying to embrace the variant thing from a legit standpoint of, man, this actually tastes good. This is actually a fun way to do this beer. It's different enough. It's still true to form, but it's something that is still within the founder's level of quality that you expect. And a cool idea that's not just ridiculous for the sake of being ridiculous.
It's an absolutely really, really good point. And honestly, you brought up the variants. It seems like that's actually kind of the subliminal answer to keeping the truck chasers at bay with the whole, oh, KBS isn't KBS. Yeah, well, here's these variants, and they're incredibly hard to get. So good luck, We saw both the espresso and the maple Mackinac fudge version in Kansas City, and both were just a huge hit. So is there a chance those are returning?
Yeah, so what we've kind of been doing is, you know, bringing out a new variant, and then also, you know, redoing their old one too, just because, like you said, they are hard to get, they're limited. If you can, like, you know, if you already got it dialed in, you already got it figured out, you might as well release it a second time. I put a lot of work into these damn things, and I hate it when you put all that work in, and then, well, we're only going to release this much of it this one time, and I'm like, man. But that's a good beer. So it's fun to revisit those things. And I hope that that is the trend. I hope that we get to the point where we can circle back and re-release some of these things. Because, you know, like I said, I worked hard on them. And I think they're great examples. And I would rather do that than just keep chasing this hype thing of something new all the time. And something that's not dialed in, not refined, not up to our quality standard. But hey, it's new. Is that good enough? I don't really want to get to that point. I would rather re-release something that's tried and true. Our portfolio is full enough. If you can't get excited about something in our portfolio, then I don't know what to tell you.
Really, really good point. And it is exciting to hear that variants are coming. It's exciting to have KBS here year-round. I think the last big brewery question that I have is to kind of put a bow here on the trends question, and just kind of pick your brain here as to see where you think the craft brewing industry in America is heading in the next 5 years or so.
Wow, what a great question. Man, I wish I knew. That would be real helpful to know that.
I can imagine.
Yeah, if you're asking me, man, I've been wrong quite a bit, even and especially lately. I wouldn't have predicted Hazy doing what it did. I wouldn't have predicted that seltzers would bleed into the craft market the way they have. I'm a little baffled right now by the industry as far as like what people are after. I get it that new is always exciting. I think the pandemic has affected some things, though. I think that, you know, there was a point in the pandemic where there was no way you were going to make your trip down to your beer store and spend a half hour looking at all the new releases, right? You wanted to grab your beer, probably while you're getting groceries, and get the hell out of there and go back home. So from that aspect, it really it did well for us because we have things like the 15 packs that represent a good value that I think people trust and believe in and are confident in their purchase, spending their money on that. So is that going to be the way things are going forward? Maybe to some extent. I think that that will have some lasting implications. But you know, you're not going to get away from people wanting to try new stuff. But is new stuff always new stuff? I don't know how many more angles can you go in the IPA segment, which is, you know, IPA is the obviously the biggest craft segment. How many more things can you do to it, and how many of those are going to have lasting implications? Like, as I was trying to avoid the Hazy thing, I had some brewed IPAs that were really cool. And so we came out with a brewed IPA that I thought was dynamite, maybe a little late to the game. And maybe there were some other examples of the style that people didn't spend the time dialing in like I did, and kind of ruined that style. And then wholesalers were like, no, we don't want brewed IPA. It just sits on the shelf. And I'm like, but you didn't even try. Give mine a try. So, you know, those things are going to happen, but that is just a glimpse into the fact that how many things can you really do with this style before, you know, it's not a great thing. So, like I said, a return to maybe some more classic styles, or classic styles with a new twist on it, I think that's where American craft has really, that's where it began. That's where it exceeds the best. You know, you're taking a tried and true thing, you know, whether it be English hoppy beers like pale ales and IPAs, and you put your own American twist on it, or, you know, you take a stout, or even like, you know, I hope that my ultimate dream is that some craft lagers can get hot. You know, I released a Pilsner with American hops. It's been a couple of years now, and I really believe that was going to be a thing. Like, I love that beer, and it got great response here at home in our tap room amongst employees and locals. Just didn't really catch on the way I thought it was going to. I thought a Pilsner which was kind of a style that was growing. It's sessionable, it's light, it's easy drinking, and featuring some American hops in that to give it a different twist. I really thought that was going to be a thing, and it didn't generate the excitement that it did with me personally. But I'm not giving up. I think variations on lagers and modern twists is certainly a viable direction to go in, and I'm going to keep my eye on that one for sure.
Oh man, please do not give up. If the 5-year outlook for the craft industry is matching exactly what you're predicting through your realm here, then I'm all on board. That and the hot pale ale. Yes, please.
Yep.
Before I let you go, I got one.
Butter up.
Five heavy hitters.
Hey, butter, 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 butter. Totally random questions.
Okay.
But just off the wall. All it takes is a response. So question number one, what is the craziest thing you have ever put into a beer that came out all right?
That came out all right.
Or terrible, your call, one of the two.
I think one of the more polarizing things I ever did was a ginger, lemongrass, and chamomile beer. Now I did it for we have a local art competition and we make a beer for that every year. So I thought I was being artsy about it, but it was pretty polarizing.
I can imagine. Actually, and I didn't even plan on bringing this up, but you sir, are actually one of the sculptors behind one of the more polarizing beers I think I've ever had, which was the Bliss Blast IPA.
Oh my God. Is it polarizing or was it just hated?
No, that's not very fair. It was definitely unique. It was, it wasn't like anything I'd had before.
Well, you know, I mean, in the name of innovation and this was the same guy that I was getting my maple bourbon barrels from. And he's like, well, I've been aging hot sauce in these bourbon barrels. You wanted to give those a shot? I'm like, well, hell yeah. You know, I'm always thought about, I guess I make pepper beers and I like that kind of stuff. But yeah, that was a lesson learned. I probably won't try that again.
I'm glad to have the untapped check-in. I'll put it that way. All right, moving on. We'll do question number two. If you could be a member of any TV sitcom family, which one would it be?
Oh, a sitcom family? It doesn't have to necessarily be a family. I love Seinfeld. I would love to hang out with that crew.
That's a good one. That's a good one. I like that. Just being around in that that apartment.
It dates me a little bit, but man, I just that shit cracks me up.
Question number three. What is, in your extensive history of brewing and barrel aging, the absolute hardest beer to brew?
Well, you know, because I'm a brewer by tradition, I generally try to keep things fairly simple on the hot side, like when we're actually brewing it. And then I make all my weirdo additions on the cold side. And I do that because once you add something into the hot side, you can't get it out. If I'm putting a spice in or something hot side, it's probably a little easier to manage then, but you know, the flavor you get is what you get and you can overdo it. So I generally lean towards making the cellar team steep bags of things, coffees and spices and things in the cold side after the beer is already fermented. And it's way harder and more dangerous to deal with there, but I think it's better for the beer. You have more control over it, especially as you're starting to figure things out. So I put a lot of my shitty work on those guys. But anything that requires of hanging bags of things into tanks is a huge pain. And I'm sorry to everybody out there that has to do that.
Is there an example that we can find on shelves that has exactly that?
Well, the Sumatra Mountain Brown and the Underground Mountain Brown had insane amount of coffee in there. I really wanted to feature the coffee in that beer. So it was like double what you find in a breakfast stout. And that was just, you know, that's a lot of weighing stuff. We released a beer called Marvel Roast a couple years ago. I don't know if you had any of that, but you know, between nibs and vanilla and coffee, that was a lot of screwing around there.
All three of those beers though came out quite fantastic.
Yeah, see, good things come to with the effort.
assuming kind of a follow-up on question three there, assuming that the answer is different, is there a beer that is just insanely hard to barrel age?
No, putting in barrels is we kind of got that down, and I got a pretty good handle on how long it's going to take. Now let me just say, I've got it down for bourbon barrels. As we kind of like start checking out some other spirits, you know, with the Masagabe going into tequilas, I did some rum barrel beers. I would say the rum barrel beers for that was a weird experience. That was we bought a bunch of rum barrels sight unseen, and some of them were in some pretty rough shape, you know, leaking all over the place as these things start to dry out. So the nice thing about bourbons is they get used one time. That's, you can't be a bourbon and reuse the barrel. So generally when you're buying bourbon barrels, they're in really good shape. But if you go to buy a tequila or a rum barrel, they'll use those things over and over again until they barely hold liquid. And then they're ready to sell them to the brewers. And now we have to these things that, you know, are so dry and old that, man, they might not hold liquid so good. You might end up dripping half of it out onto the down the drain. So those other barrels besides bourbons have been the hardest thing to get used to.
That's a good answer. That's tough. I guess it never even struck me that bourbon barrels are one-time use and everything else is, here's the remnants.
Yeah, exactly.
Question number four, better sandwich, peanut butter and jelly or grilled cheese?
Ooh, I'm going to go grilled cheese. Okay. I'd like to add some things to that too, but yeah, for the starters, I'll go warm and gooey.
That's fair. That's good. Cheese is pretty damn addicting. So yeah.
I mean, right.
Final question, question number five. What is the song that is most frequently played during the brewing process for you, either over the speakers in the brewery, if that exists, or in your head?
Yeah, so we used to, rocking out music was a huge part back in the day. Now that we've got multiple breweries and, you know, safety protocols in place, we don't blast music the way we used to, where you hear the music above anything else going on. Now, you know, you got to pay attention a little bit more, but I would say probably one of the, and we're a bit diverse as far as like what music gets played. But I'm going to go with Black Sabbath in general. Any Black Sabbath brings back fond memories of me just rocking out when I was the only guy making beer in this place. Chances are I was going to throw some Sabbath on.
That's awesome. That's awesome. That's a good answer. That's a good brewing kind of music right there too. Jeremy Kosmicki, brewmaster, Founders Brewing Company. Is there anything that I've missed that you just really want to hit on here?
Oh man, that was a lot of fun. It was great talking to you, and I appreciate you giving me the platform to, you know, talk.
Come on, I'll talk. Yeah, no, man. You're obviously always welcome in Kansas City anytime.
Well, I'm due for a trip. I'd love to come back and eat some barbecue and drink some beer with you guys.
Sounds like a blast, my man. Thank you again very, very much. Look for Founders Brewing Company on taps and shelves around the Kansas City metro. And Jeremy, thanks, man.
Ounces of Information by Central States Beverage Company.
So we're just doing audio here. No need to go for video or nothing.
You're more comfortable using video. I'm open to it, but you know, obviously I can't use video for podcasts. So I figured, you know, I know some people have issues like talking just to a screen. So if you,
no, I'm all good. I've talked to Stranger Things before. So,
okay. Well, that's good. this we've actually met before. Very, very briefly, whenever you came to visit us, we saw each other at Beer Station.
Yeah, I was going to say, I did Kansas City years ago, and I loved it. That was an awesome town. And
kind of why this isn't necessarily an unfamiliar thing to me. I remember having that conversation, and it wasn't me leading the Q&A. The knowledge that was dropped during that was just mind-blowing on the founder's process. If it's anything like that, and I have every indication to believe it absolutely will be, I'm very excited about this conversation. So.
Awesome. Well, there's definitely been a lot of changes since then, and I'm happy to talk about it.